All right, in my last sermon we looked at it was two sermons ago, right? The unjust ecclesiastical trial in front of the high priest, where they accuse Jesus of blasphemy when Jesus agrees to the title of the Anointed One, or the Christ, and the title Son of the Living God. Jesus accepts those titles. They say, that's blasphemy, you deserve to die. Now, it is early in the morning, that would have been Thursday, shortly after midnight, or so maybe Friday morning, shortly after midnight of Thursday. Now it's early morning, Good Friday, and the Jewish priests and the elders have dragged Jesus before the Roman governor, who is in Jerusalem for the Passover festivities. Pilate usually lived in Caesarea, but he had a palace right off the side of the temple that he would come. He'd come in there for Passover. It's called the Fortress of Antonia, and it's in the northwest corner of the temple. I'll show you a model and a photograph in a minute here where that was. The governor's name is Pontius Pilate. He was already introduced to us in verse 2. Luke 3 introduces us to him as well. Pilate was appointed the governor of Judea by Emperor Tiberius only a couple of years earlier in 26 A.D., And this was the emperor-appointed governor over the Jews, Pilate is, facing off against Jesus, who is accepting the title King of the Jews. Jesus potentially poses a direct threat to Pilate's hard-won position of authority. And as Pilate considers Jesus' case, there's at least two things that I think we also need to consider ourselves. One is Jesus really king? And secondly, what does it mean if he is a king? Well, how does that apply to us? Is Jesus really a king? And how does that apply to us? These are things that Pilate had to grapple with. He didn't arrive at very good conclusions. Now, to get to this point, the chief priest has correctly linked Jesus' claim to be the Christ, the Son of the Living God. He's established that in the ecclesiastical trial. Are you the Christ, the Son of God? You've said it. That's been established. The priest correctly links that not only with divine sonship, which means blasphemy to him anyway, but also to political rulership over God's people. Nathanael makes that connection in John chapter 1. When he first meets Jesus, he calls Jesus the Son of God, the King of Israel. The terms are connected. Son of God means King of Israel. It was understood that the one implied the other. The anointed one, who is the Christ or the Messiah, would not only be anointed to be the ultimate prophet and priest, but also the anointed ultimate king of God's people to fulfill God's covenant with David, that there would be one of his descendants reigning on the throne forever. So the priest's focus in the civil trial of Jesus before Pilate, the priests are going to focus on those political ramifications in hopes that Pilate will view Jesus as a political troublemaker, a rival king, and therefore kill him. The Gospel of John chapter 18 gives us some more detail of what's going on in this civil trial. The priests are careful to stand in this northwest corner here of the temple because this is a feast day. They're going to be sacrificing their lambs for the Passover that evening, and they don't want to be unclean when this happens. So they're not going to step into this Gentile fortress here to have a meeting with Pilate. because there are Gentiles in there, and that would make them unclean, and they couldn't observe their Passover. So the governor acquiesces to this by coming out to them, rather than making them come into his fortress. Now, the right to a trial before a magistrate is a key part of Roman culture. In Acts chapter 25, hopefully you can see that well enough, Festus, who was a successor of Pilate, said, "It is not the custom of the Romans to hand over any man before the accused meets his accusers face to face and has an opportunity to make his defense against the charges." This is Roman custom. The accused needs to be able to stand before his accusers in the presence of a Roman magistrate and answer the accusers. this is part of the culture. The Jews accusing Jesus are going to bring the accused, Jesus, before the magistrate and give their accusations. Jesus is going to have a chance to respond to those accusations, and then Pilate, as the Roman judge, decides what to do. The priests have pulled an all-nighter in order to be first in line before Pilate. A.T. Robertson, in his Bible pictures on the New Testament, suggests that this part of the reason for trying to get in first in line early in the morning was that a lot of the people from Galilee who were there for the Passover were probably staying outside the walled city, probably waking up a little later, coming into the city a little later, so there would be fewer Galileans sympathetic to Jesus in the crowd at the time that this trial would happen. So they could more easily get the crowd convinced to condemn Jesus. Pilate observes that the priests are carrying in a man who is bound and beat up. So he correctly surmises they're delivering a suspected criminal to him, asks what the accusations are. And in the words of the parallel account in Luke 23, they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man perverting our nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar and saying that he himself is the anointed one, a king." They go on to say that they've tried Jesus and found him worthy of death. That's in the John 18 account. "And since it's illegal for us to kill criminals, we're bringing them to you to kill them." Now, they're right that the church has no business killing criminals. Killing criminals is a function of civil government, according to Romans 13. The governor bears the sword. From these words, but these words that the priests are, these accusations that the priests are bringing, have got to be mighty suspicious as Pilate hears them. You think about this. What business did the church elders have in trying a criminal for treason? And then telling Pilate how he should be punished. I mean, they're way out of line here. These are church folks, and Pilate is the civil governor. For them to tell him what to do, I would be annoyed if I were Pilate. And here they're bringing Jesus up on charges of tax evasion. Since when were the Jews anxious to pay taxes to Caesar? There's something fishy going on. Not only that, they're claiming Jesus should be killed because he claimed to be the Messiah. Now, when were the Jews not wanting their Messiah to come? I mean, come on. And furthermore, Pilate knows that if he were to release a revolutionary for this occasion of the feast, it would make the Jews happy. So why are the Jews acting all upset that this revolutionary has been making claims? It just doesn't add up. It can't be adding up in Pilate's mind. And we see later on in verse 18, he knows it was out of envy that they've delivered him up. Since when did a mob of indignant Jews ever wait for permission to kill somebody? They didn't wait for permission to stone Stephen. Here they are with a religious kook. Why didn't they just kill him? Something's not adding up. So Pilate invites Jesus into the fortress and asks him, "What did you do to get into this predicament?" And Jesus answers unexpectedly in John 18, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would fight. Pilate's response must be, whoa, he really thinks he's a king. What a kook. But to his credit, he's not stepping on my toes. He's not claiming to be the king of the Jews. I'm in charge of the Jews. He's saying he's in charge of something that's not of this world, not part of the Roman Empire. He's not trying to threaten me. So far, so good. This is now where Matthew comes in with his Matthew chapter 27, verse 11. Matthew begins here. Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor spoke, asking, "You, are you king of the Jews?" And Jesus said to him, "You said it yourself." In John 18, 37, Jesus adds that he is the king over the realm of truth, and that everyone who is into truth is under his kingship. And Pilate's reply is classic. What is truth? And Pilate goes back out to the priests and elders who are hanging out in the temple courtyard. He's not waiting for Jesus to answer what truth is. Pilate's not interested in submitting to Jesus' authority over the truth or over him. He doesn't see any harm in letting some kooky philosopher roam the streets claiming to be the king of truth. And so he's going to just dismiss the case. He goes out, tells the priests, "I find no fault in this man." Well, this response brings a frenzy of accusation from the priests. They didn't want it to turn out like this. So they start raising more accusations. Verse 12, "During the accusation of him by the chief priests and the elders, he," Jesus, "answered nothing. It was then that Pilate said to him, 'Don't you hear what sorts of things they're testifying against you?' Yet he did not answer him, not even to one statement, such that the governor was especially amazed." The truth is, Jesus hadn't told anybody to stop paying taxes. When people in Matthew 22, they asked him, "Should we pay taxes to Caesar or not?" He said, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's." Jesus had never made any kind of political moves against the Roman government. He obeyed the laws. There was nothing to stick on him. Pilate could tell that something was going on under the surface. Jesus is totally unafraid. He's afraid. He's not afraid of Pilate. He's not afraid of Pilate's authority to put him to death. He's not defending himself. He's not using his rights to defend himself in front of the magistrate. Pilate doesn't know what to make of it. It's almost like this guy wants to get killed. But how do you punish somebody who wants to get killed? It's just a strange situation for Pilate. And the parallel accounts in John 18 and Luke 23 record some of the accusations that were made against him. "We have a law, and by that law he ought to die because he made himself out to be the Son of God. If you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar." And he stirs up the people teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee, even unto this place, Jerusalem. "Wait," says Pilate, "did you say Galilee? Galilee, this man's from Galilee, he's been causing trouble here? Well, I'm not governor over Galilee. That's Herod's bailiwick. Get out of my hair, let Herod try this case." So Pilate sends Jesus over to Herod Antipas, but Jesus won't talk to Herod. Herod talks to him, tries to get him to perform a miracle. Jesus won't do anything for Herod. So Herod gives up and sends him back to Pilate. And I suppose that as far as Herod is concerned, Jesus is obviously no longer in Galilee. He's in Jerusalem causing trouble. So that's Pilate's jurisdiction. Let Pilate deal with his own problems. So he sends Jesus back to Pilate. Pilate by now has had a little bit more time to think about this case. And he comes up with this creative idea. Verse 15. "Now during the feast, the governor had a custom to release to the crowd one prisoner," which they wanted. "And they were incarcerating a notorious prisoner named Barabbas. Therefore, after having gathered them together," that's the chief priests and elders, "Pilate said to them, 'Which do you all want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who's called the Anointed One?' For he perceived that it was on account of envy that they betrayed him. Now, who is this Barabbas? Mark 15 notes that Barabbas was part of a band of men that had murdered people and had tried to overthrow the government in an insurrection. He was a John Wilkes Booth, so to speak. But he was even worse because his band of thugs was also beating up people and robbing them, according to the account in John 18. This guy was a, the worst sort of criminal. But as a gesture of goodwill to make the natives happy on their Passover, the Roman governors of Judea had a custom of releasing a prisoner and letting the Jews choose which prisoner would be released. Barabbas appears to be the only person in jail at the time. So the choices are pretty extreme. It's Barabbas, the murderous robber, or Jesus, a.k.a. the Christ. And it's interesting to note similarities and differences between these men. There are about six manuscripts, Greek manuscripts, that add the first name Jesus to Barabbas' name. Barabbas would have been a family name, like a last name. So it's possible both of these guys are named Jesus, the Savior. Both of them represent the Jewish Messiah, the ideal of deliverance from oppression. Barabbas, however, had gone about the messianic dream from a physical perspective of military force and overthrowing physical rulers. Jesus, on the other hand, was fulfilling the messianic dream from a spiritual perspective. He was tangling with Satan. He was exorcising demons. He was overthrowing the reign and power of sin in people's lives. Which way of going about the salvation of God's people would the Jews choose? And a corollary to that is, which way of going about solving your problems will you choose? Do you want the Barabbas sort of deliverance, or do you want Jesus' kind of deliverance? Well, this was Pilate's great idea, to present a choice to the people that are gathering in the temple courtyard for Passover. And of course, they would choose this innocuous but quirky guy, Jesus, because, who would want to send the murderer and robber back into the population? That way, Pilate's going to get what he wants. The Jews will have made a choice, so they get what they want. And everybody's happy for the holidays, right? It'll be great. He didn't reckon on the Jews, though. He was still learning what the Jews were like. He was a foreigner, had only been in Jerusalem and in Judea for a couple of years. Luke 23. So Pilate called together the chief priests and rulers of the people and said to them, "You brought unto me this man as one that perverts the people. And behold, I, having examined him there before you, found no fault in this man touching the things whereof you accuse him. No, nor yet Herod, for he sent him back to us. And behold, nothing worthy of death has been done by him. So, y'all want me to release to you the King of the Jews? Let me give him a whipping and then release him." Then as he was seating himself upon the judgment seat, his wife sent a messenger to him, saying, "Let there be nothing between you and this righteous man, for I suffered many things last night, and a night vision on account of him." It appears that the negotiations are over. Both sides have had their say. And so Pilate is sitting down on the bema seat to render the final verdict, judgment. And it's at this point that this message comes from his wife. Coptic tradition tells us that her name was Abrokla, or some of you I've seen Prokla as a similar name. She brings this new angle to this crazy case. It's this onar, a vision or a dream, like the one that the Magi had when God didn't want them to reveal Jesus' whereabouts to Herod, and like the dream that God gave to Joseph when he said it's time to get Jesus out of the country so that Jesus isn't killed as a child. This appears to be a piece of advice given directly from God, almost directly from God, to a civil ruler. It's giving Pilate the information he needs to rule justly. And if Romans 13 is correct, then governors, civil authorities, are ministers established by God. God has established them, and God has an interest in giving, equipping them with what they need to judge well. Should we be surprised then if God gives key information through supernatural means to rulers on occasion to help them do their job in the best way? I believe this is one reason why we should keep praying that God will do this kind of thing to give wisdom to our rulers even today. Matthew Henry noted a few more applications to this. This is cause for hope in the face of a corrupt government. He said, God will not leave himself without witnesses to the truth and equity of his cause, even when it seems to be most spitefully run down by its enemies and most shamefully deserted by its friends. God will not leave himself without a witness to the truth. Even in the Babylonian Empire, he raised up men like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. He doesn't leave himself without a witness to the truth. There is always hope for reformation. And secondly, Matthew Henry notes that Pilate's wife provides a good example for all of us to be witnesses of the truth ourselves. To be some of these witnesses to the truth. He said it's an instance of true love to our friends and relations to do what we can to keep them from sin. And the nearer any are to us and the greater affection we have for them, the more solicitous we should be not to suffer sin to come or lie upon them. Pilate's wife gives us an example of speaking up to a family member and warning them not to do something that would be wrong. Now, part of what is interesting here is that God does this, sends this message through Pilate's wife, even though it's God's will and intention that Jesus end up dying on the cross. God does not reveal this information in such a compelling way that Pilate and the crowd can't resist it. It's easy to imagine that the men present in this court case thought it terribly inappropriate for a woman to try to influence the outcome of the trial. How seriously should they take it that the governor's wife had had a bad night's sleep? Maybe the worst that could come of overruling what she her piece of advice here might be Pilate sleeps on the couch that night. But the message could be dismissed pretty easily. God speaks with a still, small voice, typically. And it's just enough to let a spiritually sensitive person know that this man was innocent of any crime. Often when God speaks, it is with a still, small voice that can be ignored. It can be drowned out. And we, who are followers of Jesus, need to discipline ourselves to listen to that still, small voice and respond rather than ignoring it like Pilate did. In verse 20, the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowds that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. Now, the crowds in the temple are naturally going to find these priests pretty persuasive. After all, it's these priests that can excommunicate them. And, you know, they're no longer going to be able to live in Israel anymore and enjoy holidays with their family anymore if they get excommunicated. The priests were the ones that could get their sins forgiven. If the priest isn't going to be willing to take their sacrifice and offer it on the altar, then there's no forgiveness before God. So the priests have a great deal of influence. And they obviously want Jesus destroyed. They want him put to death, executed. So what's going to happen to me if I stick up for what I think is true and I go against what the priests say and say, don't kill Jesus. He's innocent. The priest might make an example of me too. I might be the next person brought up before Pilate. It's also very easy to judge by appearances, isn't it? Here Jesus, he's all beat up, he's tied, he may have been whipped by this time. John 18 puts the whipping earlier in the sequence. He sure looks like a criminal. It's easy to judge by appearances, isn't it? And come to think of it, he never did muster an army. Never did do anything to resist the oppression of Pilate like Barabbas did. At least Barabbas did something. Jesus doesn't even have any followers anymore. No disciples, no followers. Nobody's going to stick up for him. I'm not going to be the only one that sticks up for him. I don't want to be the only one. How many of these kinds of things are influential in your decision making? They sure tug on my heart. I want to be on the good side of the powerful and influential people. I don't want people to be mean to me. I don't know what all the spiritual realities. I can see the physical realities. It's easy to judge from that. I don't want to be the first one to take a stand. I want to be popular. If these are the main ways we make decisions, though, we're going to crucify Jesus over and over and over again. These are not the ways to decide what's right and wrong. They're not the ways to decide what we should do. We need to be listening to the voice of the Holy Spirit as it is amplified through our reading of Scripture, and we see that it is true. And we need to simply do what God calls us to do, rather than what is popular or what will make people treat us well or what looks good. Well, in response, the governor says to the people, verse 21, "Which of the two do y'all want me to release to you?" And as for them, they said, "Barabbas." Pilate says to them, "What then shall I do to Jesus, who is called the Anointed One?" And all of them say, "Let him be crucified." I do think that there must be some tongue-in-cheek here for Pilate, somewhat of a put-down, as he's standing before these Jews, and he's calling this rejected, neglected, beat-up man the Messiah, the ultimate prophet, priest, and king of the Jews. He can't really be... It's hard to imagine that Pilate is really taking this seriously, this title seriously. I think it shows disdain for the Jews and disdain for this physically weak and wretched and friendless man, Jesus, calling him the Greek word for Messiah. It's a way of rubbing it in who the real king of the Jews is, and that's Pilate. Pilate's the real king of the Jews. You know, this guy's a loser. A little earlier on Palm Sunday, the crowds had been hailing Jesus as the Messiah, but now in front of the crowd, they're not willing to acknowledge that. In fact, their crowd's realizing that if they acknowledge Jesus to be the Messiah, then they'll actually be siding with the Roman governor, which is something they never want to do. It would be affirming Pilate as king at the same time if they were calling Jesus the Messiah. Well, the crowd didn't respond the way Pilate wanted. Pilate was hoping to just let this lunatic off. He didn't mean to kill Jesus. He probably meant to teach Jesus a lesson to be a little more careful about what he said and not stir up trouble. Didn't mean to kill him, though. So Pilate pushes back some, and there's some back and forth between Pilate and the priests. Actually, the next two Greek verbs are in the imperfect tense. It might indicate they're actually yelling on top of each other, starting to talk before the others finish. Pilate says to them, the governor was speaking frankly. For what reason? Has he done something bad? But as for them, the crowd, they were crying out too vehemently, saying, "Let him be crucified." They have no good reason to put him to death. So all they can do is just repeat, "Let him be crucified." Or repeat at least what they were told to say by the priests. And this is, by the way, how democracy works. Influential people can manipulate the majority of the people to vote for just about anything. Only a belief in a sovereign God who will hold each of us accountable to his standard of justice on Judgment Day can guard a nation from this kind of arbitrary injustice. Democracy can't guard us from injustice. Only a belief in absolute the laws of God, personally applied to us, can keep a democracy from injustice. The parties here end up settling on opposite sides of the question. Pilate doesn't want to take responsibility for killing Jesus. The crowd does want to take responsibility for killing Jesus. So Pilate, verse 24, having seen that he was gaining nothing, but rather a riot was developing, got some water, rinsed off his hands from in front of the crowd, saying, "I am innocent from the blood of this righteous man. Y'all have to watch it yourselves." And in reply, all the people said, "Let his blood be upon us and upon our children." Now, Pilate has a bit of a conflict here. It is his job to maintain peace and order in this part of the world with the Jews of Judea. And he is answerable directly to Caesar. Caesar appointed him to be governor of Judea. So if it gets reported back to Caesar that a tumultuous uproar broke out under his nose at Passover, Pilate could be back out on the streets looking for a job. He had already had a difficult life before now. Pilate could see that trying to reason with his crowd about Jesus' righteousness was not accomplishing his desired outcome. He wasn't going to prevail in this argument. Yet Pilate, the same as any magistrate, was responsible before God to uphold justice and never condemn the innocent. All but three of the thousands of Greek manuscripts out there quote Pilate as calling Jesus a righteous man in verse 24. And they aren't even the three oldest Greek manuscripts that omit righteous. I think it's irresponsible for the NAS and NIV and ESV to leave out the phrase righteous in verse 24. But regardless, it was a sin for Pilate to abdicate his responsibility and allow Jesus to be crucified because Jesus was not a criminal. And I call it a sin because Jesus said so himself in John 18. Maybe a lesser sin than that of the priest, but a sin nevertheless. His job, Pilate's job as magistrate, is don't condemn the righteous. Condemn the guilty. So he washes his hands. This is a symbolic action, much like baptism is symbolic of having guilt removed from you. There's a convention for a hand washing in the case of a murder mystery in Deuteronomy 21. Whether Pilate was following this or not is questionable. There were also pagan routines for doing this too, so may have not been necessarily a following of Deuteronomy 21. But the physical act of washing, though, did that change whether Pilate was guilty or not? No. The reality is a matter of what you actually did and didn't do, not whether or not you did some symbolic washing. The reality is what Jesus did or didn't do for you. to pay for your sin. But much as Pilate did not want to riot, he also didn't want to get crosswise with whatever deity this Jesus was connected with. So he washes his hands in an attempt to try to distance himself from this. The crowd, on the other hand, has no qualms with taking on the responsibility before God for the death of Jesus. This was stupid to ask God to hold them accountable for an innocent man's death, for murdering his son, and reckless to commit the guilt to their own children, too, sure to share their guilt. But what's ironic is that this very blood that they asked to be upon them would, for some of them, wash them clean of their guilt instead of drawing the wrath of God down upon them. That is amazing love, amazing grace. Now, Pilate tried to say he was not responsible for cruelly murdering the man that he had proclaimed innocent, but by his deeds, Pilate was responsible. Pilate was the one who caused Jesus to be crucified. If he had withheld that verdict, Jesus wouldn't have been crucified. It wasn't the Jewish priests that crucified Jesus, it was Roman soldiers under the command of Pilate. Actions speak louder than words. So he releases Barabbas to the crowd and delivers Jesus to be crucified after having him flogged. And the only thing that Pilate may have done really to distance himself from this crucifixion, maybe, was that he didn't go out to watch the crucifixion. And that's how I interpret his parting words to the Jews: see to it yourselves. You go watch his crucifixion. I don't care to watch this man suffer. The NIV interprets Pilate's last words much more figuratively than the actual Greek words are. Literally, Pilate says, "You will watch it yourselves." So the whip slashes across Jesus' back time after time, up to the count of 39. I imagine the prophecy from Isaiah 53 going through his head. He was beaten as a result of our iniquity. Chastisement for our peace was upon him. And by his stripes there is healing for us. All we, like the flock, have strayed, each has faced toward his own way. But Jehovah interposed in him the iniquity of us all. The punishment of Jesus, which brought the release of the convicted criminal Barabbas, is a picture of what Jesus was doing. He was offering his sinless life to God to pay for the offenses of sinners whom he loved, so that those sinners who believed in him would be released from God's judgment. This is a picture of what Jesus did. John Calvin wrote of this: "The Son of God stood as a criminal before a mortal man and there permitted himself to be accused and condemned, that we may stand boldly before God. For if we recollect how dreadful is the judgment seat of God, and that we could never have been acquitted there unless Christ had been pronounced to be guilty on earth, we shall never be ashamed of glorying in his chains." Do you believe that? Do you believe that Jesus is your King? If so, will you tell others about him, like Pilate's wife did? Stand up for his truth, even when it's unpopular. Or will you be like Pilate and show by your actions that other people are really king in your life? It's other people really that control you. Jesus came to take our guilt and sin off of us and pay for it himself. So we certainly can be forgiven when we fall, just like Peter was forgiven after he denied Christ. But let us, like Peter, grow in courage to honor Jesus as king, no matter what the opposition. One day when we see Jesus coming in the clouds of heaven with power and glory, our faith will be vindicated. Jesus really is king. He's the king of the universe. He's the king of the Jews, and he is king of me.